We're back for part two of our episodes of The Promise of Restorative Justice. I'm Hannah Stanley, and this is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. You can find this podcast, you probably did find it, on WGNplus.com, and please remember to subscribe as well so you can get all of our great content. Right now, I'm joined by Dan Cooper, co-executive director of Adler's Institute on Social Exclusion. Dan, you say justice reform is both a moral and financial issue, and that there are very clear economic reasons to move towards restorative justice. Please tell me more.
Sure. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here. And so just in case you weren't swayed by Elena's arguments about the personal and transformative benefits of restorative justice, I'm going to zoom out a little bit and talk about how the average taxpayer should really care about this because, yes, it's a moral issue, but it's also a common sense economic issue, right? So Elena touched a little bit on how expensive it is. Just to elaborate on that further, locking up a young person typically costs about $500 a day. The average length of stay in a juvenile detention center here in Cook County is about 30 days. So, that's about $15,000 locking up a young person for a month, we could have them in the Drake Hotel, right? And this is particularly problematic given the track record of absolute failure of juvenile detention and adult incarceration. So the reoffense rate in Illinois for juveniles is something around between 50 and 60%. So that means once a young person is locked up, there is greater than a 50% chance that they're going to go back in again. In any other circumstance, this would be looked at as a dismal failure, right? If this were a business or if this were education outcomes, you would say, wow, this is a scandal. We're failing half the time. This clearly is not rehabilitating people. So for something this costly, we should be going all in on looking for other alternatives like restorative justice. To zoom out from just this cost perspective, young people are returning to a very small number of neighborhoods, like Back of the Yards in Englewood, which you're going to hear about in a second, from Father Kelly. So that means that one of the greatest investments we're making in neighborhoods is in suppression and enforced removal. So some folks in New York at Columbia University coined the term million-dollar blocks, meaning that on some blocks, just a block, we commit to spending over the life of sentences over $1 million locking people up.
Per block.
In a community like Austin, this could mean, hundreds of millions of dollars committed, taxpayer dollars committed to locking people up. For an approach that fails 50% of the time.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Because if we were actually like going to whiteboard this with a group of taxpayers, they would go, no, this needs to get fixed now.
Yeah.
But we're so used to the system the way it is.
Right.
And not necessarily knowing more about the alternatives.
That's exactly right.
So see, people, you're so smart for listening because we're presenting we're presenting the options.
Yeah, thanks for pointing that out. And another thing I should also mention is that not only is this costly and not cost effective, it's actually harmful not only to the young people in terms of psychological damage and trauma, but it's harmful to families and neighborhoods as well. So this investment we're making in locking people up is actually hurting neighborhoods. So there's some really compelling research that has shown that incarceration, juvenile detention, are making neighborhoods perhaps even less safe. And like you said, all because we're sort of hooked on this approach and we can't really think outside of the box and think about a better approach to public safety. So for example, the violent crime rate has been going down pretty steadily since the early 90s. And the incarceration rate at the same time has been going up, but has leveled off a little bit in recent years. And so there's a temptation to say, oh, well, maybe incarceration is responsible for that crime rate going down. But some folks have actually studied that. Some folks at the Brennan Center at New York University found that the drop in violent crime is only marginally, at best, attributable to incarceration. To incarceration. What it's more attributable to is things like growth in income, employment rates, a decrease in alcohol and substance abuse. So all these things that we would think of as positive social programs, social support, community development are actually the things that are driving public safety, not incarceration. And then what's worse, we know from even more recent studies, is that incarceration is actually responsible, perhaps, for an increase in poverty. Some folks from Villanova did a study recently showing that the poverty rate would actually be much lower had we not been incarcerating at the rate we are. And then also crime. A researcher at Rutgers, Todd Clear, showed that in several different cities where we incarcerate more, we see later rises in crime rates.
All right. So the people who are incarcerated when they come out then recommit crime.
That's exactly right. Okay. So there's this revolving door effect where people are leaving a community, going to prison, coming back with a record, a stigma.
Harder to find jobs.
If you're a young person, you're less likely to finish school. You're less likely to find a job. And then you're excluded to the margins. And one of your only options, as you see it, is perhaps, selling drugs or doing something else in the informal economy. And crucially, most of these youth, as we'll hear from Father Kelly, are typically failed by systems, schools. They feel disconnected from adults and every system they've been a part of. And so these are the folks who are, again, who are going to be our reentrants, who form this revolving door effect.
Right before this last stat that you expounded upon, you said that incarceration actually increases poverty level. I think you said it was a Villanova study. Tell me a little bit more about that, please.
Yeah, so they basically looked at the poverty rate and looked at incarceration across the states, and they did a couple models to look at what poverty would have been without incarceration, and actually would have been lower, right? So
because we're incarcerating workforce,
right? Exactly. So they're returning. They're not finding jobs. They're sort of excluded from employment. More likely to reoffend. Crime goes up. Poverty goes up.
This
vicious cycle. And again, we have this very short-term memory because these are the same communities that were victims of redlining in the 60s. And we sort of ignore that. They're the same communities that are victims to failed schools, to predatory lending just 10 years ago, to foreclosures, and more recently, school closures and state budget impasse, which has decimated the social safety net and social services. And so to look at juvenile justice without considering all these other terrible policy effects that have impacted these neighborhoods would be an incomplete picture. So, essentially, these young people are being punished. These neighborhoods are being punished in the form of years of bad policy.
Adler is located here in Chicago. All of our guests for these three segments on restorative justice are located here in the city of Chicago. But I appreciate that you're bringing in backup from across the country, and because these our community is not alone. This is something that's mirrored throughout the country. And these are concepts that you can carry on into your own community and really start to address and incorporate these ideas that we've been discussing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell me what investments we can make to do it better.
That's a great question. So we're going to hear very shortly from an excellent program, a restorative justice program that works comprehensively with young people in a very cost-effective way. But in general, thinking about neighborhoods where young people come from, who are typically locked up or face disproportionate contact with the justice system, are the same areas that have all sorts of issues, right? Mental health services are underfunded, education systems are failing, workforce development, we're constantly cutting programs that are meant to help the young people and families in these neighborhoods. It seems like every week we hear of a new social service provider who's had to shutter their programs because of the current budget impasse, which is essentially an ideological fight with the victims being the people who are most marginalized in society. I think Lutheran Social Services just a week or two ago announced they had to shutter their programs. They provide services to nearly 5,000 people, employ 750 people. So in general, we need to redirect money from the juvenile justice system, from the criminal justice system in general, into all sorts of programs that would help lift up families, give them job skills, access to better health and education. And for young people, importantly, there are programs we know that help connect them to their peers, to adults, to school. And, you know, restorative justice programs, restorative justice hubs in particular, are one that really work to take a comprehensive approach to mentoring youth, to helping them build social skills, you know, peer relationships, connecting them with their community in ways that incarceration sort of doesn't do.
Now is the hard question, because we are already in the vicious cycle. We have a very ingrained system, and we have an issue with our budget. Many, many states and municipalities have budgetary issues where everybody's cutting money, and it is harming those who are most at risk. That's fact, because those are programs that are easier to cut. And where do we step in to stop this? We want to incorporate restorative justice. That's going to cost money. We want to make sure that we can rehabilitate people either prior to going to jail or when they come out. That's going to cost money. So at what point, where is it most ideal to step in and go, okay, we're going to stop the cycle now, and I'm going to do it how?
Yeah, it's a great question. And the good news is that we have an area we could easily find cuts because it's the most expensive approach, and that's detention and incarceration, right? As I mentioned earlier, the $500 a day cost figure. Restorative justice programs, you know, may cost a couple, you know, several hundred dollars or several thousand dollars per youth, and that's, you know, much less than this $15,000 per month from locking up a young person. So the first thing is to look really hard at where we're sentencing young people and do everything we can to divert them from the system into something that's more cost effective. That's something that can yield some savings very quickly. And there are approaches that do this. Illinois has a program called Redeploy Illinois, which is supposed to provide financial incentives for diverting young people away from incarceration and into better evidence-based programs and supports. But, you know, the program has had some success, but it hasn't really taken hold in Cook County, and there are ways we can go much deeper. There are states that have done this over a longer period of time and have seen some pretty successful results. Ohio is one, for example. They found out, or they realized very quickly in the early 90s that they had a problem when there were 2,500 youth in the juvenile correction system where they only had the capacity for 1,400. And so not only is that a problem for safety for these young people, it's also massively expensive, right? And so they embarked on a 20-year effort to de-incarcerate and shift expenses into better evidence-based programs, mental health programs, substance abuse programs, social support, mentoring, similar to kind of what programs exist here in Chicago, not exactly the same, but and then rigorously testing what works. And then they've showed over the years that some things haven't worked, but they've steered things more and more to approaches that do. And they've been able to reduce their incarceration budget by a huge factor.
Cook County has what I believe is a trial program for the Veterans Court. It's Veterans Court, and they go into a special system, and they have very rigorous, as you just laid out, psychological help and programs to get them through substance abuse and things like that. Is this something that could be modeled after that, which is working? From what I understand, where there can be, you have to qualify for this, but then we can go, look, it works. See, this is proven. We can do this because it has to be something where they're going to see that it works, or nobody's going to agree to it, because nobody wants to be the politician that lets the kid out that then, you know, goes and does this horrible crime again.
Right. Yeah, I mean, the good news is there's plenty of evidence out there about restorative justice practices being effective, of mentorship programs and other programs for youth, mental health and behavioral health programs working. So there's a body of literature. I think you heard Elena mention it earlier, you know, young people who go through a restorative justice program are, you know, maybe half as or, you know, 50% less likely to reoffend, for example. So I think it's a combination of investing in what we know works, but then also taking a rigorous social science approach and saying we're going to do everything we can to test new approaches that work and not just rely on the same old, same old. The irony here is that juvenile detention and adult incarceration are not evidence-based programs. We know they're failures, actually, because half the people go back in, right? Mm-hmm. There's no evidence really to suggest that that's working and rehabilitating people, but yet we hold any alternative to a higher standard and say, ooh, we're a little bit hesitant to invest in that because we're not sure that's an evidence-based program yet. And I think we need to be a little bit more bold in looking at all sorts of innovative approaches that do everything they can to connect young people with families and with community like restorative justice practices do.
So we have the backup. We have the ability to look and say, look, this is proven. It's more effective. At least it's more effective than what we're currently doing.
That's right.
How do we get this change implemented? Is this through the politicians, or is this judges, local courts? How do we get this to work?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's something that Illinois has a commission on criminal justice sentencing reform right now that are providing some recommendations for adults. And you know, I think one of the big recommendations is to really you know, invest in evidence-based approaches, but also, you know, one thing we would push is say, you know, justice reinvestment now, right? Just let taxpayers know, the public know how much we're spending and wasting on ineffective programs that are ruining young people's lives, destroying neighborhoods. So I think above all, what, you know, we need more public education. We need a movement so that people really know this, how ineffective their system is, and can put a little bit of pressure on, you know, politicians. I think there are state level opportunities for legislation, but also judges need to be educated, probation, parole. I think, you know, the justice system is not just a unidimensional system. It's a living, breathing organism with a lot of different tentacles. So I think there will have to be a lot of approaches to make this work.
Which is true in so many different aspects of this system and many others. Dan Cooper joining me right now. He's the co-executive director of Adler's Institute on Social Exclusion. And this is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. I'm Hannah Stanley. I want to address, you've mentioned a few times that Elena Quintana was with us in a previous podcast. So if you're looking for that, please do so at WGNplus.com. Or you can subscribe via iTunes or whatever method you download your podcasts from. We will be on there as well. And again, it is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. And then coming up next, we have Father Kelly talking about a program that is working in the community and helping to bring around some restorative justice in Chicago's South Side. Thank you, Dan, so much for your time and your figure that you brought us, really proving, driving home the point that this is a better option for many, many communities, including our own. As I mentioned before, please do subscribe. And if you like what you have heard and are interested, please feel free to share it on your social media networks. Hannah Stanley here. This is On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. We will continue with Father Kelly in our next podcast.